I felt like a marionette going down a mountain. I could barely hold myself up.
Holly Brooks reclaims the women's Mount Marathon title. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, examining the impacts after last week's 7.9 earthquake in the Aleutians.
There's a short-term impact to birds, but it's the very forces of nature that those birds depend on in the long run to provide their habitat.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Tens of thousands of spectators were on hand in Seward for the start of the 2014 Mount Marathon race today. After coming in second last year, Olympic skier Holly Brooks has reclaimed her title as winner of the women's mountain marathon race. She finished the 3,000-foot climb in 52 minutes and 49 seconds with 2013 champion Christy Marvin right behind her.
It was a tough field. This is the deepest women's field in a long time, so I didn't know what was going to happen.
Brooks has competed in Mount Marathon six times and come in as runner-up in half of those runs.
You know, I've been second three times in this race. Twice I've gotten past on Main Street right here, and that was all I could think about. I didn't want to have to think about that for another year.
The three-mile race is always grueling, but the dry weather this year meant runners had to contend with dust and heat. Brooks was the first to finish the uphill portion, but says the descent was a struggle.
And coming downhill, I felt like a marionette going down a mountain. I could barely hold myself up.
17-year-old Allison Ostrander of Soldotna made history in the juniors race as the first girl to ever win it. She came ahead of all the girls and boys with a time of 28 minutes and 54 seconds with a 40-second lead to spare. Eric Strabel has again won the men's division, coming in just before 4 p.m. with a time of 44 minutes, 46 seconds. Matthias Sari came in second and Benjamin Marvin in third. At a magnitude 7.9, last week's deep-sea earthquake was the most powerful to hit the Western Aleutians in 50 years. The quake didn't cause any structural damage, but it was a reminder that life in the islands can change in an instant. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has the story.
The first tsunami warning issued after last Monday's earthquake didn't include Unalaska. In fact, the quake's epicenter was far away from the town, deep underwater, 600 miles across the chain. But that didn't stop residents from taking notice.
A lot of folks might have just caught a little tidbits of it, you know, such as the word Aleutians, earthquake, evacuation, when the whole message was, you know, the warning was farther down the chain.
Unalaska Public Safety Director Jamie Sunderland says they started getting calls about the quake and tsunami risk almost immediately. They only had one dispatcher on duty and had to scramble to bring in extra staff. When a tsunami advisory was issued for Unalaska a short time later, Sunderland says it was tough to get the message out that residents didn't actually need to evacuate. Some were already heading for high ground. Of course, Unalaska had practiced for a day like this during the statewide tsunami drill just a few months earlier. But Sunderland says their experience this time showed some things are out of their control.
Think back to grade school where they had you do a little exercise where you whisper a certain phrase into someone's ear, and by the time it comes around the room, the message is completely changed. And the same thing happens as we pass messages through our various systems, as we try and abbreviate things.
In Adak, just a couple hundred miles from the quake's epicenter, the message about getting to high ground was a lot clearer.
Given the duration and intensity of the earthquake, most people didn't need much warning to go up there.
That's city manager Leighton Lockett. He says they sounded their tsunami siren right after they felt the quake. And together, about 100 ADAC residents stopped what they were doing and headed for the town's shelter, an old church on a hill.
Actually worked very well, better than any drill we could have planned for.
Despite the strength of the quake, ADAC didn't see any damages. In fact, the disaster's only victims may not have been people or property at all. Seabirds on nearby Baldir Island build their nests in rocky cliffs. When the earthquake hit, parts of those cliffs collapsed or slid away, crushing some eggs and killing chicks in the process. Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge Director Steve Delahanty was visiting ADAC during the quake. He says there's no way to tell how many of Baldur's kittiwakes, murres, and auklets were lost. But he also says it's part of the natural cycle. The birds are well adapted to a changeable environment.
There's a short-term impact to birds, but it's the very forces of nature that those birds depend on in the long run to provide their habitat.
The same is true of the people that live on the chain. Life in the Aleutians means expecting the unexpected, from volcanic eruptions to earthquakes and tsunamis, even when all that washes ashore is a wave less than a foot tall. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The White House has issued a report laying out the costs of not expanding Medicaid. Alaska is one of 24 states that rejected federal dollars to increase access to Medicaid, preferring instead to study how those who would have qualified are currently receiving care. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez joins us to talk about how the study judges Alaska. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So what's in this report?
The report looks at two big things, the economic costs of denying Medicaid access and the health costs. There are 26,000 Alaskans who currently make too much money to get Medicaid coverage, but not enough to qualify for subsidized health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The White House Council of Economic Advisers says that if Alaska had taken federal money for expansion, the state would have increased its economic output by $250 million over the next 3 years. Doctor visits would have gone up by about 70,000, and hundreds of jobs would be added to the state's economy. It also goes beyond the macro picture by looking at how many of those people who fall into the Medicaid gap would avoid catastrophic hospital bills and how many wouldn't have had to borrow money to pay for their care. Now, as far as public health is concerned, the Council of Economic Advisers projects that a lot more routine screenings would be performed on lower-income Alaskans. They estimate that about 1,000 more mammograms would be done every year, along with 4,000 cholesterol screenings, if the people who fall into the Medicaid gap were to get coverage.
So, Alexandra, how is the Parnell administration reacting to this report?
It doesn't quite sound like they're buying some of these claims. I spoke with Bill Struer, who is the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and here's a little bit of tape from our interview.
It reads more like a marketing brochure than it reads like a deep analysis.
He sees the report as a political weapon meant to put pressure on state governments that have chosen not to expand Medicaid. The way Medicaid expansion would have worked in Alaska is that the state would pay a small amount of the cost, with the federal government taking on the lion's share. And one of the things the White House's numbers suggest is that Medicaid expansion pays for itself through the ripple effect on the state's economy. Struer is skeptical of that, and he's relying on the state's own Medicaid Reform Advisory Group to figure out what role Medicaid plays in the state's economy, how the program can be improved, and how to address people falling into the gap. That advisory group will be finishing its report this fall, and Struer says if Parnell is going to revisit the question of expanding Medicaid, it'll be after they release their conclusions.
Well, last year, a lot of different groups, the Alaska Chamber of Commerce, Alaska Federation of Natives, and the NAACP were pushing Governor Parnell to go ahead with Medicaid expansion. Is this going to come up as a campaign issue?
Parnell's two biggest challengers have both criticized him for rejecting the federal Medicaid money, and they've said that accepting it would be one of their first acts as governor if elected. Independent candidate Bill Walker lists it as one of his top priorities on his website, and it seems like every other week that Democrat Byron Mallott is now sending a press release criticizing the governor for his decision. And as a Senate Democrat running for re-election, Mark Begich has also gotten in on the act, calling on Parnell to change his mind. Now, whether Parnell will, there's no indication of that. It hasn't been his prerogative at this point.
Well, thanks so much for joining us to explain this report, Alexandra.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez talking about the White House's new report on Medicaid expansion. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a former crab vessel gets repurposed as an adults-only entertainment boat.
I don't pull people out here by their earlobe. They've got to pay money to get out here. They've got to get on a small boat right out the channel.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A pop-up subsistence school has opened in a remote corner of the Aleutians. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, ATCA's second annual culture camp is meant to keep Unungan traditions going strong.
Earlier this spring, Danny Snigaroff visited the campsite where he'd be teaching younger folks how to fish and hunt.
At culture camp, we don't need no hot dog, no beef hamburger, nothing. We all need a food.
Sea lion, caribou, seal, that's what Snigaroff and other Unungan elders grew up eating, and they're still staples in ATCA. That's because most residents are living a traditional subsistence lifestyle, but it's not as common in other Aleutian communities.
There's just not been a whole lot of transmission of all of that knowledge and skills.
That's Crystal Dushkin, the Director of Cultural Affairs for ATCA's Tribal Council. She helped organize the community's first ever culture camp last summer. Putting traditional foods at the center made sense.
It's very specialized, you know. It's not something that you could learn out of any kind of books. Sure, you could learn anatomy and all kinds of things about animals, but you can't learn what these elders have to teach from any book.
Or in a classroom. That's why the camp is being held on Coravin Beach in ATCA. It's a good place to learn about hunting and gather plants, and it's a good place to actually make camp.
We'll have all our meals and sleep out in the tents, whoever wants to.
Right up until the last day. It falls on a Russian Orthodox holiday, so to honor Saints Peter and Paul and celebrate the end of camp, the village will hold a potluck, gathering around the foods that have sustained a culture for centuries. I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A program airing this Sunday on the Smithsonian Channel works to capture the majesty of the 49th state. Toby Beach is the producer and director of Aerial America. The show features all 50 states, but only Alaska was given a two-hour treatment. Beach says the program cuts through the distorted view that people may get from the flood of so-called reality TV shows about Alaska.
We filmed everything from the Iditarod up to Denali, north of Denali to the north of the mountain to the park, and then all the way down through Juneau and the Panhandle. So we've covered a huge swath. We haven't covered everything in Alaska, which would have taken much, much longer. but we have covered a huge amount of territory for these two programs.
Is it unusual for there to be two programs? Is it normally one, or is this the usual setup?
No, the Alaska programs are unique in that there are 2 hours on the state. And given the size of Alaska, I think we could have done 3 hours. it was very hard to even imagine trying to tell Alaska's story with a single hour. So we came up with an idea for splitting our stories and covering more territory for 2 hours. And we've never done that for any other state.
What was the overall effort? How did you decide what to sort of focus in on?
We tried to do two things. One is to capture the true spirit of the Alaskan people, and then to take a look at the landscape and what really makes Alaska, an incredible wild land, and also to cut through a lot of the cliches that I think a lot of people have of the state, their understanding of what Alaska is, which, in the lower 48, a lot of that understanding comes from reality shows and other sources. And so our goal was to really try and tell Alaska's true story and to capture, the people who live there and have chosen to live there.
Toby Beach is the producer and director of Aerial America. A 2-hour special on Alaska will air this Sunday at 8 p.m. on the Smithsonian Channel. A lot of fishing boats were removed from the Bering Sea crab grounds after rationalization prompted a huge surge in quota stacking and consolidation of the fleet. Some crab boats sit unused in harbors. Others are being used as tenders in other fisheries. But in Kodiak, one has been turned into a strip club. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more.
Well, that's just after 8 p.m. Before that, the MV Wild Alaskan is a bar and restaurant offering harbor charters along with sweeping views of Kodiak's waterfront from its position anchored up just offshore. The 120-foot Wild Alaskan used to be the fishing vessel Shaman, a legendary crab killer that also pioneered a shrimp fishery in Hawaiian waters. Darren Byler bought the former Shaman 7 years ago and has used it for big game guiding, wildlife viewing, and on extended trips for reality TV shows.
When we're not doing our bear viewing, I told my wife we need to keep the boat busy, so I had an idea to start up a channel charter opportunity for the community to be able to come out on a beautiful 120-foot vessel and have a cold beer and some entertainment and some good food and have the best view of the channel of sitting right here between two boat harbors.
Byler said the Wild Alaskan will have at least 5 dancers on duty, all of whom, he says, come from the Lower 48. He said the Wild Alaskan will operate seasonally, catering to different sets of visitors throughout the summer and fall.
We're planning on operating into, you know, late November. There's sport fishermen in town, out of state, deer hunters, bear hunters. This would be a perfect opportunity for them to be able to experience this, and along with the local community and the commercial fishing fleet, of course. We've had lots of fishermen out here so far that love this charter opportunity, and a lot of people said they've had this idea for years but just never got around to doing it, so it's been a big hit so far.
The Wild Alaskan ran into some rough water just a few days after opening, which had them shut down last weekend. The water taxi they use has a rated capacity of 6 people total, but it was operating with a crew of up to 4, which put them above the limits of their 6-pack license. That snafu was cleared up on Monday, and the Wild Alaskan is operational again. However, Byler is aware that there will be some in Kodiak who object on moral grounds to a boat full of exotic dancers anchored just offshore.
You know, it's just another opportunity for entertainment. It's just about in every town in this country. It's legal and accepted by society. And I don't pull people out here by their earlobe. They've got to pay money to get out here. They've got to get on a small boat right out the channel. And it's a pretty private setting, so it's not like that you're walking down the mall and the door swings open and a new, all of a sudden you get your eyes full. This is a private setting in the channel for adults, and it takes a little bit of time and planning to get out here.
Kodiak hasn't had a strip club for over 30 years. And even then, the city tried to have it shut down. However, in 1980, local attorney Jerry Markham, who took the city of Kodiak all the way to the Alaska Supreme Court, won the right for Tony's Bar to have exotic dancing. Today, at least 2 night spots in town occasionally bring in female and male dancers to entertain.
That report by KMXT's Jay Barrett.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ellen Lockyer. This week on AK, farming. The dream of homesteading and living off the land is part of Alaska's mystique. Few succeed. But the couple, which owns Chugach Farm, have made it work on only 1 acre in the middle of the woods in Chicoloon. Johanna Urich visited Jed and Allie Workman for a trip from their fields to the farmer's market.
Just past a white truck on a dirt track lies Chugach Farm. Started 12 years ago on 2 acres. Today, much of it is still wooded. Jed and Allie Workman bought it for $5,000. all the money they had at the time.
We don't ever want to owe anyone anything.
Ali remembers that first winter. It was cold and tough.
We were sleeping in our outside. It was like 40 below, and that was a real instigator for building this place as quickly as we could, albeit with a $7 book on how to build a shed from the thrift store, which turned out to be absolutely horrendous.
In the beginning, they spent their summers guiding on Denali and rushing back between climbs to garden and put up food. Along the way, they built an off-the-grid homestead, complete with chicken house, solar panels, seed house, and root cellar.
Still 40 in here. Warmest it's been all season now.
They built a scribed log sauna where Ali dries teas, a greenhouse, hoop house, compost heap, and pig pen. They do it all, hunting, fishing, berry picking, and farming. Most of what Jed and Ali eat is something they shot, fished, gathered, or grew.
I would say 95% of every meal, a lot of times 100%, is local.
One thing's changed. Ali doesn't guide climbers anymore, and Jed does less of it. However, the evidence of their old profession is everywhere. Skis are built into fences and gates. Posies grow in old ski boots by gardens named after mountain ranges. Now, Jed and Ali work 15-hour days producing food to eat or sell in Anchorage.
Garlic, broccoli, cauliflower.
Chugach Farm's 1 acre is a maze of garden plots with row covers. Every bed produces multiple crops. Ali makes a detailed plan during the winter, so when one crop is done, it's pulled out and something else is ready to go in.
I'm gonna get a bucket going.
We need twisties, bags. Grab the other harvest knife.
On a recent Friday, I joined the harvest along with two summer volunteers. We cut greens, wash them, then dry them in a giant salad spinner. Before packing them for sale. It's a long morning, but we're done before lunch, or so I thought. And then we set up to move the new high tunnel, something no one's done before.
Can you knock that pipe so it wants to go this way?
The high tunnel is being moved to cover pumpkins and squashes already planted to help give them the heat needed in our short, cool summers. With boards, pieces of pipe, rope, and carabiners, we follow Jed's direction, but he's not sure it'll work.
Can we give it another little pull and see?
Ali starts the chainsaw rigged to a power winch. It moves.
I thought it wasn't going to move, but hey, we got it to go.
Slowly, we got there. There's not an inch to spare. Jed picks up the tools and thinks about the life he and Ali have made.
There's a lot of people out there wandering around, and I was one of those people. But by taking this on in this little nook of woods has given us a lot of leadership in our own lives, taking our vision and making it our life.
The next morning, I ride back to Anchorage with Ali on her way to the Spinard Farmers Market.
All right, it's going quick.
Going quick.
Get while you can.
I line up with other customers, knowing what I'm getting from Chugach Farms. It's more than organic vegetables and a great wild pesto. It's the taste of a dream rooted in place and the people who shape it.
How much are they?
They're three each, that's six.
I'm Johanna Urich.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're visiting the interior village of Tanana.
My name is Donna Mae Folger. I wear many hats in this community. For one, I'm the mayor of Tanana, a volunteer mayor of Tanana. And for where I make my money, make my living is I work for Tanana Tribe as TFYS, social service, and I work with the tribal courts, our Tanana tribal courts. Tanana is located on the Yukon River. We're just about smack right in the middle of Alaska map. We're at a place called, what are Native people called, Nuchalawaya, and it's where the two rivers meet, where the Tanana River meets the Yukon River. We have about maybe 200, less than 300 people here, including kids. The biggest thing I think we might be having trouble with is no fish. No fish, just no salmon. We're waiting for the silvers and the full-time fish. we're not getting to eat the salmon, so that's the big impact, you know. And May 1st, we had a tragic happen where one of our young men shot and killed two state troopers here. And things have been pretty bad for a while, but, you know, as the river flows, I'm looking at the river, watching it go, and life goes on, and we just pray that those families are doing okay. And, you know, it's a hard thing, and one day at a time, we'll get through it. We're a pretty strong community. We have different colors of people living here, and, you know, peace be with you, and, you know, peace be with us. That's it, I guess.
Donna May Folger is mayor of Tanana. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Johanna Urick, Joaquin Palomino, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ellen Lockyer. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Seward. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Standdown event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.